Okay, so let's just go through the precepts very briefly in the context of, kind of the basic way of keeping these ones. And then later on in the retreat, we'll get into like how a monastic keeps them, which is somewhat different. Okay, so the precept to not kill is not killing. That's it, you know. I think we all know what killing is. But it means having an intention to kill. So clearly stepping on an ant accidentally is not a complete break of the precept because there was no intention to do it. If you eat meat and you killed the animal yourself or you ask somebody else to kill it for you, then it is. So actually that's an important thing about killing is it's not just doing it yourself, it's also asking somebody else to do it. And so a full break of it involves, killing a human being with recognizing who that human being is and having the intention to do it. Killing an animal isn't a full transgression of it. Stepping on an ant accidentally, being in a car accident, these things are, there's either they're missing the object or the intention or the action isn't complete. You intend to kill one thing, but you kill another. Yeah. Okay. So, but in any case, we can see that killing is damaging and hurting anybody physically is also damaging. And so that's why at the retreat we really try and be careful not only of each other but also of all the ants and other little critters around. So that is a whole mindfulness practice in itself, catching them. The night before last, I was lacking in sleep because there was a cricket in my room who decided to start chanting his mantra in the middle of the night. And I first, it woke me out of my sleep and I thought, and I hit the alarm clock, and it kept going. And then I realized, no, that's not the sound of the alarm clock, that's a cricket. Gee, it's so loud, it must be in the room. And I couldn't find it anywhere. And he just kept, chanting mantra. And so last night, when I went in, I was looking at the Taratanka, and there was some piece of something in the kata. And so I went to pull that out, and it started wiggling up. And so after several attempts, I finally succeeded in catching the little guy and escorting him out. And he jumped back in, and I escorted him out again. So that he could chant with his friends and I could sleep. It was a very thin little thing. I expected them to be, really quite bigger, I thought it was a stick at first. Okay, then not stealing is not taking things that don't belong to us. And that includes, it's not a full break, so you don't have the intention to keep it yourself, but not using things that belong to the community that are not put out for community use. Okay? So that means, not going in and taking things out of the drawers or using this or that if it's not something that's for community use. Now, everything that's out on top, or visible in the bathroom, the soap, the shampoo, not people's individual toothbrushes, of course, but that stuff that's out, that's for community use, the hand lotion, the soap, whatever it is. If you need, first aid stuff, yes, that's freely offered. Go and help yourself. It's in the laundry room. Brooms and cleaning equipment, of course, is for community use. But, other things, it's always good to ask before if you need something. Okay, then the third one is keeping celibate. And so what we're doing for, you know, in, usually for lay people, it's to avoid unkind and unwise sexual expression, which you, the principal thing there is, if you're in a relationship going outside of the relationship, or even if you're single going with somebody who's in a relationship. But there's all sorts of other, I think that precept actually calls into question, you know, what is wise sexual expression, what is kind sexual expression. That's how I worded it. You know, Vasubandhu has a whole list of you can do this and you can't do that. But, you know, when you tell Westerners this, they go totally bananas, you know. So I and also I think then people just get stuck in the technicalities of, well, can I sneak around it by doing that, not doing this? And, you know, we get very legalistic and miss the point of the precept. So I think it's actually much better to just do some reflection about what is kind and what is unkind sexual expression, what is wise sexual and unwise sexual expression. Okay? But here for the retreat, it's celibacy. Okay? So that includes no masturbation. The thing about keeping celibacy is that when you're a celibate, your life actually becomes so much simpler because there's only so many other things you don't need to do. Because you don't need to wear jewelry to attract people. You don't need to wear perfume and aftershave to attract people. You don't need to dye your hair or get hair if you don't have any. Or, you know, if you're going bald or something. You don't need to worry about all those kinds of things because, you know, the whole way that we decorate ourselves and care about our appearance is so that we can attract somebody, basically, isn't it? I mean, we want to look good in front of our friends, but that's so that they think we're attractive and can get somebody. You know, so it's all really quite stupid, isn't it? Yeah, and then it also really makes relationships quite complicated. Because, you know, I mean, like when you're celibate, then there's no reason to flirt with anybody. Yeah. Now, we all know what flirting involves, don't we? We all know how to flirt. And you know how you walk when you're flirting. You know how you use your eyes when you're flirting. You know how you use your voice when you're flirting. And you know how to pretend that you're doing all of this without any intention at all. Right? Yeah? So, you know, it just consumes so much time and energy, doesn't it? And, you know, we're walking in the meditation hall and like, okay, I'm walking in. I wonder if he's going to notice me or, you know, or if she's going to notice me. You know, who knows? People are attracted to all sorts of people, up, down, and across, and, you know. So that person, them. Who knows if they're going to notice me? You know, and how am I walking? And can I arrange to bump into them accidentally? You know, and you know, how, it's all this kind of stuff. I mean, we know what it's about, don't we? You know, kind of checking our zits in the morning and checking the hair and making sure you're closing. In so many trips that we go on. When we're trying to attract somebody else. Yeah. So when you're celibate, you drop all that. It really makes things very simple and very direct. Okay, then not lying. So the full transgression is lying about your spiritual attainments. So, you know, claiming to have realizations that you don't have. And that's really dangerous because, you know, it misleads a lot of people. So that's the principal one. But then, of course, any kind of lying is, as we all know, very destructive, isn't it? And lying is the one big way to break trust. You know, because if somebody lies to you, you usually don't trust them very much after that, do you? So the same goes if we lie to them. One of the guys I wrote to in prison, I was reading his letter yesterday, and he was saying that when you're in prison, you don't have anything that the Department of Corrections doesn't allow you to have. So the only thing that you really have is your word. And if you lie, then your word is meaningless and you don't really have anything. I think that was quite interesting, you know, because on the outside we think we have a lot of stuff. Yeah, we do have a lot of material stuff, but our word is really the principal thing that enables other people to trust us. So lying is the big way to destroy that trust. Okay, and then taking intoxicants. This one isn't differentiated into what is a root transgression and what's a branch transgression. So it's taking any intoxicants. The question always comes up, what about homeopathic medicine that has alcohol in it? What I do is you leave your medicine out for a few minutes, the alcohol evaporates, then you take it. Or you put in a little bit of hot water and that makes the alcohol evaporate, then you take it. People ask about cooking with wine. I think food tastes just as good without the wine, even though the alcohol is evaporated. You might get the liquor taste, and that might remind you of the wine. So some people give this precept differently. They say, oh, yeah, it's fine to cook with wine because it evaporates. But, you know, I just think you have that taste, and it might spark a memory of something else. Other people say, oh, you can drink, but just don't get drunk, or you can smoke some, but don't get intoxicated. But the problem with that definition is that you don't know if you've gone too far until after you're there. Do you? You know? And, you know, I just think it's too confusing. You know, if you give our mind an inch, it'll take a mile. And I just think it's much easier, no intoxicant. And the Buddha himself said, when he was speaking of liquor, nothing even the size of a dewdrop. So it just makes it very clear, you know. And people who've been to AA, they understand this. Yeah. Because the moment you say, oh, just a little bit, you know, you're gone. So it's just much easier, nothing. Now, while the precept talks about intoxicants in that way, you know, illegal drugs and alcohol and abusing prescription drugs, which actually I was very surprised to learn that there's more death caused by abuse of prescription drugs than by illegal drugs. Yeah. So be very careful about prescription drugs and, you know, where you leave them and who else has access to them and when you use them and so on and so forth. But if we look deeper, we have many ways of intoxicating ourselves. Yeah, the computer is one, the television is one, shopping, gambling, all sorts of different things that we use just to kind of intoxicate ourselves and space out and, you know, numb whatever is going on. So we kind of self-medicate through a variety of different methods. And although the precept refers specifically to those kinds of things, and plus tobacco, you know, in the Mahayana tradition, tobacco is considered under intoxicants. I think if you think more deeply about the precept, well, what other ways do I intoxicate myself? And so it can really lead to some good reflection. Yeah. Bags of chips can be a big intoxicant. I don't know who does that, though. Do you know anybody who does that? You do? Really? What happens when they eat bags and bags of chips? So they're not intoxicating themselves? Mm. They are. Okay. We'll be sure and, you know, look after them. Those people who do that, yeah. You already looked. Yeah, for those other people who might be addicted to chips. Okay. So, you know, just to expand it. And then also, of course, while living at the Abbey, you know, no singing, dancing, playing music. The reason for that is, again, it just takes us outside of ourselves and we lose our mindfulness. And often we do those things either for distraction or so that people will pay attention to us, don't we? Yeah. If I sing, everybody will know I have a wonderful voice. If I dance, they'll all look at me. If I play music, they'll faint. What a good, you know. So, you know, that's very often used either for distraction or to draw attention to ourselves. Of course, if we're chanting mantra or whatever, hopefully our motivation is different. If it's not, then check up. Yeah. And then we don't sit in high or expensive, you know, beds or seats or whatever. And this kind of translates into sitting in places of importance. No, or sitting, yeah, sitting in places of importance. You know, how often we enter a room and where can I sit? You know, because the placement of chairs indicates who's important and who's not. Where can I sit where people will notice me? Where is the nicest, most comfortable, largest chair for me to sit in? You know, we all have attachment to our own nice little seats, yeah, don't we? And so just looking at that. And, you know, for the duration of the retreat, you know, you're not taking the precept to avoid eating in the afternoon, but, you know, just some kind of have some mindfulness about our eating too. Okay, so those are the basic precepts. And wearing ornaments and perfumes and decorations, things like that. Again, it's done so that we'll look good. So, you know, check out the things that we use to decorate ourselves with. Now, sometimes amongst Tibetans and amongst Westerners too, watches are big status symbols, aren't they? You know, if you have a gold watch, it kind of flickers and glows. Wow, must be wealthy. You know. So how what we do with our hair, how we decorate ourselves, basically, and then use scents and different things like that. So we try and get everything here that's unscented, but it's really difficult. And so some stuff has scent in it. Somebody just gave us a whole bunch of lavender or soap or something. I found it in the bathroom. I put it in the gift, the shelf to give away as gifts. Yeah. So, you know, we do our best to not use scented things. Any questions? Yeah. That's just considered kind of, you know, unmindful behavior. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things about etiquette that we learn as monastics. And I remember, you know, very clearly when I was in Taiwan that they said, you know, don't jump up and down and don't shout to somebody, you know, in somewhere far away. And when you see an old friend, don't go, ah! You know how we do sometimes. We haven't seen somebody for a while. you know, so that we're really emphasizing, have some feeling of decorum around, you know, around how you behave.
It doesn't really apply to how we live here, but when I hear talk about, you know, the killing precept or asking somebody to kill, but then people who eat meat, in some ways it seems like they're disconnected from that, so it doesn't seem like they accumulate the same karma, yet at the same time it's like they're removed from it in a way that seems...
Yeah. Okay, so the whole topic about eating meat... you know, they say in relationship to the precept on killing, don't kill the animal yourself or ask somebody else to kill it for you, or eat it if you know it was killed specifically for you. Okay. Now, having said that, that does not mean that eating meat is karma-free. Because clearly when there's demand and there's supply and so on, so then people have to accept, I think, that karma consequence. Just to let you know, I don't want to get into a big discussion about meat right now. It's written about in my books. Please read the books first, and then if you have more questions, talk to each other. Because I've talked about this up, down, and across, and, you know, and then it's always, you know, well, what about if we, you know, so it's like all these people trying to be lawyers. And the idea is, you know, let's work with our mind. And, you know, His Holiness himself, you know, he says he's a part-time vegetarian because his doctors told him to eat meat. You know, but anyway, I'm so tired of talking about that. So please excuse me. Any other questions? Okay, we finished meat, okay? So now there's sex, and there's rock and roll. Okay, yeah? Okay.
So am I right in understanding that taking intoxicants, one can't break at the root? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, the reason you don't break the intoxicant at the root is that there's some precepts that are made because the actions themselves are naturally negative. In other words, whoever does them, whether that person has precepts or not, creates harmful karma. And then there's other actions that are not naturally negative actions, but are dangerous if you do. Okay? So killing, stealing, unwise and unkind sexual behavior and lying are naturally negative. Yeah, so then there's the distinction between breaking them at the root and other ways of breaking them, which also create negative karma, but it doesn't make you lose the precept. And then intoxicants, and taking intoxicants is not a naturally negative action, but it's very dangerous, because they always talk of the monk who was being held hostage, and he could either kill the sheep, sleep with the woman, what was the other one?
Drink,
and then there was some other thing, you know, or kill somebody or something like that. You know, so he thought, oh, well, drinking something, well, is the lesser of, you know, I don't want to sleep with somebody, I don't want to kill somebody because I'll lose my ordination if I do. So drank and then did the other two. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So intoxicants are quite harmful in that way.
And you had mentioned yesterday about the... when I've been divided into the two categories, is it basically following that same idea as the thing that, you know, are negative in and of themselves and that things to protect you from doing anything?
What two categories was I referring to?
I thought
one was
governing etiquette and the other was...
One was what?
Governing etiquette.
Uh-huh.
And the other was... one was how we interact with each other, and one was how we behave in general, I think.
Counteract naturally negative actions, and counteract actions that can lead us to create negative actions.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it was that. Okay. Yeah. So like singing, dancing, playing music are not naturally negative, But if you do them, it could lead you to, you know, infringe other aspects of your root precepts. Okay?
What about abortion in terms of killing a human being?
It's killing. Yeah, abortion is killing. And because it, from a Buddhist viewpoint, the consciousness enters at the time of conception. So it is killing. I don't think it's good to, you know, personally, I don't get involved in the pro-choice, anti-abortion debate because I think both sides are approaching it in the wrong way. Yeah. But in any case, if you've done that, then it's good to do some purification. Also including in the precept, the killing precept for monastics, the way it is, and we'll get to this later, is encouraging death. You know? So if somebody is very sick, saying, oh, your life is so useless, and you're in so much pain, you know, how about some euthanasia, or, you know, whatever, like that. So, you know, helping somebody who wants to kill themselves because they're in terminally ill, don't get involved in it. It's, you know, from our point of view, it's killing. Yeah. The reason for that is that you ostensibly it seems like compassion to euthanize an animal or you know, even a human being. If we have clairvoyant powers and we know that where they're going to be reborn is in a good realm, then euthanizing them and sending them to the better rebirth, that's okay. But if you euthanize them and some negative karma is going to ripen, they may be actually going to a state of more suffering than they're in right now. And often, although we talk about euthanasia in terms of for their benefit because they're in so much suffering, actually it's often because we can't bear to see them suffering and we feel so much discomfort about it. You know, human life always has value. Even if somebody is very, very ill, if they know how to, they can still make their life useful and meaningful. And so, you know, if somebody's able to live longer, then I think that's good. Even they get imprints of, you know, you play some kind of chanting or you read Buddhist texts out loud to them, even they're in a coma or whatever. Puts good imprints on their mind stream for future lives. Okay, let's get into the benefits of taking precepts. A lot of these other questions you can discuss amongst each other in the break time, how you feel about different things and if they make sense to you or don't make sense to you. Okay, so there's 10 advantages to the Buddha establishing precepts. And they're divided into detail and then in general. And among those in detail, they're divided into three categories: to promote the harmony within the Sangha, to transform the society, and to bring about individual liberation. Okay, so to promote the harmony within the Sangha. Okay, so the precepts, you know, they create harmony within the Sangha. Actually, the Vinaya is one of the first legal codes on the planet. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so even though it is a legal code in the sense that, you know, it has all the rules and, you know, definitions of the rules and things like this, it's actually designed as something to help us train our mind. Yeah. So I think it works better to see it as a method for training the mind. But to be aware that when somebody infringes upon this, they are also endangering their membership in the Sangha community. And so that's where the legal aspect of it comes into focus, because if precepts were broken from the root or whatever, then you have excluded yourself from membership in the Sangha community. Okay, so it's not a question of other people kicking you out, it's people who break from the root have excluded themselves through their own behavior. Okay, so, but I think seeing the things as a way to train the mind is very, very helpful. And, okay, I can see I'm going to have a few things to say before I get into that. First of all, to tell you how the precepts came about. Yeah, because we usually think, okay, a legal code, somebody sat down and made up rules. So the Buddha sat down and took out his pen and paper and made a constitution or something. No, that's not the way it happened. What happened is at the very beginning, you know, after the Buddha attained enlightenment, when people wanted to become his followers, he just said, come, O Bhikshu, and that was their ordination. Okay, and so they just became a follower of the Buddha in that way. And I think it was for the first 12 years or so, nobody did anything, you know, really, really awful. And then, there was one monk who, I think he was an only child, and he had been married before he became a monk. But didn't have any children. And his parents were very upset because they wanted a child, you know, a grandson, because it was thought that when you die, you know, your grandson was the one who was supposed to do the funeral rites for you and pray for you and make offerings on your behalf. And if they had no heir, then, because their son had ordained, then what would happen to them when they died? So they asked their son, please come back and, you know, just get your wife pregnant and then you can go back to being a monk. So it kind of seems like a good reason, doesn't it? Yeah, you kind of think, well, yeah, you know, for the benefit of other sentient beings, my parents are really unhappy. You know, they want it. They want an heir, and they're unhappy. I don't want to make them unhappy because I care about mother sentient beings. And so he went back, and he had sex with his wife. And then, of course, the other monks, when they found out about this, reported it to the Buddha. And the Buddha called him here, and he said, you idiot, you know, what do you think you're doing? I don't think Buddha said it exactly like that, but, you know, he said, no, that is not suitable behavior for a monastic. And so from now on, you know, there's the precept of celibacy. And so, you know. And I find it's very interesting that it was that story. You know, it wasn't the story of some monk seeing some beautiful woman and jumping into bed impulsively, and then that was it. Because that's kind of clear that that's just based on attachment, isn't it? You know? So this story, you could actually, you know, rationalize about how compassionate and nice he was being to his parents, couldn't you? Yeah. So I find it's very interesting that it's that event. The Buddha said, no, you can't irrationalize, dear. You know, that's a transgression of not what you're supposed to do. Okay. So all the precepts came about because people did naughty things. Yeah. And then it got reported to the Buddha, and then the Buddha established the precept. Okay, so it wasn't that the Buddha started out with all these things. It's they came to be, all the precepts came to be created over a period of time. And then, you know, some of the precepts also came to be altered and exceptions made, because the Buddha would set it down one way according to the event that had happened, and then a slightly different but slightly similar situation happened. And then somebody did that, and they'd go to the Buddha and say, is that a break too? You know? And so then the Buddha would have to, he started differentiating, you know, what actually entailed a break versus what didn't entail a full transgression. So there's different levels of offense. There's a, you know, a slight offense, a serious offense. There's a full transgression. So then the different precepts got amended to, make this kind of differentiation. You know, so like with a celibacy precept, somebody might come and say, well, I kissed somebody, you know, it was that breaking celibacy. Well, you know, it's not keeping it perfectly, but that isn't a major transgression. You know, that isn't breaking it from the root, and you're not excluding yourself from the Sangha altogether if you do that. However, there is negativity, and you have to purify it, and you have to confess it. Okay, so all these things got set up according to circumstances. Now, some of the circumstances, well, all of the circumstances applied to in ancient Indian culture. Some of those circumstances apply today. I mean, killing is killing, and stealing is stealing, and lying is lying. You know, all these kinds of things, it applies equally today. Then there's other aspects of things where the culture is very different today, and the circumstances are very different today. And so I think here is where some adaptation is needed. And in addition, there's things that happen today that are not written in the Vinaya because they didn't exist at that time, that I think if the Buddha were alive today, he would make precepts about. Okay? And so that's where we get different precepts or guidelines for the monastery in particular. You know? Because although the Buddha said we can change the pratimoksha, it entails the community getting together and agreeing on it. You know? And since Ananda, people in the Vinaya so often they blame poor Ananda. I mean, I think Ananda was just incredible, but he gets blamed a lot, you know, because he didn't ask the Buddha what's the difference between the major vows and the minor vows. And so even though the Buddha said you can change the minor ones because Ananda didn't ask that question, then some people say you can't change anything because we can't tell the difference, although it's actually very clear according to the categories of precepts which ones are more major and which ones aren't. Okay, so I think we also need some cultural sensitivity, you know, and then there's certain precepts where the point of the precept is maybe not so clear when you just read the precept. So, you know, all these things need to be understood in context, and especially within the context of a particular society. Okay, so for example, I was at a teaching one time when a Tibetan Lama was talking about the lay precept of avoiding unwise and unkind, you know, of unwise sexual misconduct was how he was translating it. And the example he used was that if you go to a prostitute and sleep with her, but somebody else paid for her, then that was sexual misconduct. Implying that if you paid for her, it wasn't. Well, if you ever needed a chimney shaft, I would have been happy. Of course, I sat there sweetly because, but I mean, that doesn't go in our society, does it? You know, that just absolutely does not go. So, you know, although among some people, you know, some people it's blame the prostitute, isn't it? You know, and they arrest the prostitutes, but they don't arrest the people who go to the prostitutes. So, you know, but I think if you really think about it, it's, you know, people never say when they're little kids, I want to grow up and be a prostitute. You know, I mean, people don't go into that profession by choice. You know, it's by, you know, poverty, or they're sold into it, or, you know, who knows what. Okay? So, you know, so there's many things like that where we really have to look at the society. You know? On the other hand, in making these adaptations, we have to be very careful that we don't rationalize things. Because it's very, very easy to rationalize, to make things easier for our ego mind, saying, oh, that's just cultural, so get rid of it. Now, so it's a fine line, it's a delicate balance. And we can see just, you know, those of us who have been living here, how the rules at the Abbey, how they change and alter depending on circumstances. You know, at the beginning we didn't have many house rules, and then things started happening and we started writing stuff down. Yeah? And so we should make sure, actually, that we continue writing these things down so that people who come in the future can just sit and read them, you know, and then also so that we remember we've already decided some of these things. Okay. So that's how the precepts came into being. Okay, so in terms of that first one, to promote the harmony within the Sangha, because one of the purposes of the precepts is, as you know, a quote-unquote legal code for, it's a system of, you know, social relationships on how we're going to live together and get along with each other. Okay, and so under that, one of the benefits is that it directs the monastics. Okay, so as monastics, we then have direction in our life, and we learn how to monitor our physical, verbal, and mental actions, and to direct them in positive ways, and to abandon, unpositive ways of negative ways of using them. And so this is the, you know, one of the big things about training that happens when you're training is you're learning how to direct your energy and how to use your body, speech, and mind. And so, you know, here's where, okay, there's the precepts and then there's the etiquette. You know, there's a lot of etiquette in Vinaya, and then there's the etiquette, you know, from the particular monasteries. But we might say, oh, etiquette, you know, that's just manners and, you know, blah, forget that. But actually, a lot of our disharmony comes because of breaches in etiquette. You know, you just think about it, and so much people get angry because they did something and the other person didn't say thank you. Or the other, or if somebody asks you to do something and they don't say please with some sense of, you know, acknowledging that they're asking you a favor. So just some small things like manners can make huge differences in how people live together, can't they? You know, whether you know, sometimes you have to interrupt if you just like blurt it out, or if you say, excuse me, you know, this is a pressing point, I need to interrupt. So just learning the etiquette, I think, can make living together much nicer, and it also makes us more mindful of things that can cause disharmony. Okay, so lots of, when I was in the Chinese monastery, oh, so many small things. At first, it drove me nuts, you know, because my collar, some of you have heard this before, my collar was never neat, and they would always have to come, you know, because we were standing in rows, and fix my collar. And it's like, I was a hippie, don't fix my collar. You know, it's like, no, I'm being trained. I have to be mindful. I can't look like a slob in front of other people. And then, you know, you hold your hands the way they hold their hands in the Chinese monastery. Their palms are flat. We tuck our thumbs in, they don't. And the Chinese have, your hands are always perpendicular like this. Okay? And if you look in a Chinese monastery, everybody's standing the same way with their hands like this. If you look in many other monasteries, hands are like this, they're like this, they're like here, they're, you know, all over the place. And so just this thing of learning okay, this is where and how you place your hands. And you got to remember to do it each time. And when we walked into the hall, you know, and we didn't just throw our shoes any old way. There were about 550 of us, and all our shoes looked alike. But never mind. You know, you didn't throw your shoes anywhere and just, you know. So you lined your shoes up in a certain sequence. And we even lined up in an order and filed into the temple. Yeah. So we lined up in a certain order outside. And then when you filed into the temple, you kept your eyes down. You had your eyes down and you had your hands like this. Your hands like that. And they were at your waist and your eyes were down. Not your head down. I didn't look up, but your eyes were down. And, you know, so you weren't kind of like swinging your arms around, looking at all the people, hi, hi, if you walk into the temple. You have some kind of dignified appearance. And it was also a way of controlling the senses. Because what happens when we look around? You know, we often see things that are attractive and attachment arises. Okay? So you really trained yourself to look down in those situations. Okay, in other situations, you have to look around. Yeah, so all different sorts of things. One day, I remember because we had to hand wash our clothes, and there was a scrub brush, and, you know, I mean, I hate doing this kind of stuff. I was just, get it done. And a nun came and corrected me, you know, because you have to wash your clothes and move the brush in a certain way. You know, so this was like all new for me, and I could feel this kind of, you know, each time this little like, I'm an adult, what are you telling me this, you know, but it was actually very, very good, you know, to notice that, you know, because of that sense of eyes, what are you telling me how to do this for, you know, what's wrong with my way of doing it, and just, no, I'm here to be trained, you know, and I'm here to become more mindful about how I even do these small things. So, for example, people come to the Abbey, and one of our guidelines here is that you don't eat standing up. Well, some people, it's just like, you know, they read it on the website, but it didn't sink in, and then we have to remind them, you don't eat standing up. Oh, was I eating? You know, it's like, really, you know? Kind of not even aware. So, you know, really, you know, all these kinds of things that actually make us much more mindful. So in the full ordination vows, at least with the nuns, we have 100 kind of etiquette type of things that come at the end, and they just really make you much more mindful about a lot of these small things. But it, you know, it helps. What it does, the etiquette, is it makes your behavior very refined. And many of you who have noticed the Chinese nuns who have come here have very refined behavior, don't they? Yeah. And so it's something, this is where it comes from, being trained like this and people reminding you and then remembering it yourself. Okay, another benefit is that the precepts foster peace and happiness amongst the monastics. Okay, so it, everybody's keeping the same precepts, everybody's trying not to harm others and to be caring of others, so that fosters peace and happiness among the community. So you can see here that, you know, people comply to the precepts, even though they don't, may not like all of them or the etiquette or whatever, because they see that doing so fosters peace and happiness. And to have that attitude means that you give up wanting to do your own trip. And this is one of the hardest things for Westerners, is we all like to do our own trip. And we want to do things when we feel like doing them in the way we feel like doing them. And we don't want anybody else commenting on it. Right? Mm-hmm. So our resistance comes up big time in this area, doesn't it? Yeah. And you can see, you know, the people who have been trained, who give up doing their own trip, and the people who haven't been trained, or whose teachers have tried to train them, but they resisted it, you know, and the people who do their own trip. You can see the distinction in the behavior, you know, of how people act and how they treat other people, how they move through space, you know, how they react to all sorts of things. You know, because if somebody's making noise and, you know, we're all not mindful at times, and somebody comes up and says, "Are you aware that you're making some noise and it's disturbing?" Then, you know, if you're well trained, you say, "Oh, thank you for telling me. You know, I wasn't aware." If you haven't been trained, or you're very strong, it's like, "I'm not making any noise. Anyway, you can put in earplugs if it's bugging you." Yeah? And so you can see, you know, somebody talks like that in a community, it's not going to foster harmony, is it? You know? So this thing about giving up our own trip, it is a big one. And, you know, yesterday we were talking about monastics who live in community and monastics who live on their own. For a long time, because I was amongst, you know, the first generation, the people, Westerners who were ordained, you know, for a long time people complained, "We don't have a community, we don't have support, we don't have a community and a place to live, no, 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 no." At one point I realized, actually, it's not the lack of a place to live and a community to live, you know, and it's not the lack of support. It's what many people wanted, was they wanted the financial support, but they wanted the place to live, and they wanted people around when they wanted them around, but they didn't want to live in community. Because when you live in community, you have to give up your own trip. When you just have a room in a place and there's other monastics around, you come and go and do whatever you want. You know, kind of like you just have your own flat in an apartment building. Yeah, and so, you know, I think many people don't really want to have that level of polishing, and so they prefer to live on their own. Yeah. Because it does, you know, we comment on each other's behavior, and if you're somebody who's easy to admonish, you accept it, and if you're somebody who's difficult to admonish, you're like one of those porcupines. Yeah. Actually, we'll talk about that a little later. There's a very nice sutra that talks about what are the qualities of somebody who is easy to admonish and qualities of somebody who's difficult to admonish. I would think that we probably can figure some of them out for ourselves. Yeah. But you can see, you know, that if everybody's open to, you know, being considerate of each other and open to people reminding them of that, it brings harmony in the community and creates a nice place for people to live. That doesn't mean that the monastic community is always harmonious. Of course not. You know, as soon as you have one person, you have a conflict of opinion. Because we don't always agree with ourselves, do we? And we have civil war within ourselves. So, you know. Okay, then another benefit of the precepts is it protects the monastics. So it protects us from negative actions. It protects us from disharmony. And keeping the precepts creates a certain kind of environment whereby it becomes easy to practice meditation. Okay? And so we're not just keeping the precepts, the ones that involve the naturally negative actions, of course we're keeping them to avoid the negative karma, but then the ones that don't involve the naturally negative actions, it's not that we're keeping them just so we can take pride in keeping rules or something like that, but because everybody keeping them sets up a very nice environment so that people can meditate and go into their spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, one of the purposes we have of living together is to create an atmosphere that is beneficial for our, every individual's internal development. Okay. Now, you asked the question a couple of days ago. How did you phrase it? Something like, how do you develop meditation and concentration when there's so much activity going on? That's a good question. Okay. So there's many things here. One element is when you're a new monastery, you have to have lots of activity. Otherwise, you don't have a place to live because you're not active creating the buildings, doing the things. So one is the survival level. Second thing is when you're in the Mahayana tradition, you also do a lot of activities to benefit others. You're not just trying to create a nice, peaceful monastic environment for your own meditation, but you're trying to also create an environment where other people can come. And you're trying to engage with other people in a beneficial way. Yeah. So you'll see a difference there between, let's say, some of the forest monasteries, where the aim is really one's own liberation, and the Mahayana monasteries, where the aim is the Bodhisattva path. So you'll see some difference there. You know, granted, sometimes we all get carried away with the amount of activity and there doesn't seem to be any end and, you know, the weather is like this and so you don't get done what you think you're going to get done, so then you have to do twice as much the next day. All of that, actually, if we think about it, it teaches us some flexibility. That we have to be flexible and that there are certain situations that require more effort, certain situations where the, you know, like we close for 3 months in the winter and it's quiet and people come and want to visit for the day and we say, please come back in the spring. So, you know, there's different ways of managing that. And, you know, the activity is it's actually a good check to see what you need to spend time and energy on practicing. Because, you know, when we're busy interrelating with each other, sometimes our minds get uncontrolled and attachment, anger, and ignorance come up, or jealousy, or arrogance, or belligerence, or resentment. And it's an excellent time to see these things and say, oh, you know, this is what I need to work on in my meditation. And so sometimes things come up. There might be a small situation, but you find that you're having a big reaction to it. Then it lets you know, oh, I'm not just reacting to this situation. You know, there's some button in me that's getting pushed, or I have some preconception about how things should be or how I want them or what I don't like or what's going to happen if this and such happens, and that button's getting pushed, and so it lets you know that. Yeah. So there's a lot of value really within the activity if we use it properly as a mirror to show us how we are. And to it also shows, you know, where we've made progress, because when an event can happen 1 year and a similar event can happen a few years later, and you react in different ways because you've really been working on yourself in between. Okay? So it kind of shows you that. And I can say within myself, you know, there's some things that, oh, I was so reactive to before. Some of you even, you know, remarked on it in the FOSA meetings, you know, our first FOSA meeting, you were saying how I, you know, micromanage and I always have to know what everybody's doing because I'm afraid they're not going to do it, because usually they don't do it, and then it's, I'm left holding the bag. And nobody believed me that that happened until they came to live here, and then they began to experience the same thing, and they realized that I was telling the truth. Right? But I've also seen, for example, a change in myself over the years. It's like now I don't expect people to do that, and I don't feel the need to tell them that I don't expect them to keep to do what they said they're going to do. I just, you know, okay, if they do it, great, and if they don't do it, that's okay. And, you know, and then when they don't do it, instead of, you know, I'm abandoned and nobody's supporting me and it's falling on my plate to get done because they didn't do it, you know, instead of getting all upset, I just say, oh, well, I've been through this before. And you just, you know, every time life doesn't stop, it keeps going and it's no great catastrophe and you find a way around it. Yeah, so that, for example, I'm just giving you a personal example. That's one way that, you know, one thing I noticed within myself that, you know, that I've been working on. Hopefully you've seen some change. Have you seen some change?
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. I think part of the change is that some more people have come to live here, you know, which has helped. But even when things fall apart, I, you know, I don't get as, you know, totally upset as I used to. Okay, so these kinds of things, you know, when you're active, this is stuff that you see, and then you know, okay, I got to work on this one. Yeah, where's this coming from? Okay.
You know, I also think what you said about ethics this morning was also very helpful in this way. Develop the mindfulness and the monitoring alertness necessary for concentration down the road.
Okay. Okay. Then there's two advantages that help show the benefit of transforming society. Okay. So the advantage, it benefits people who already have faith, and it also benefits people who don't have faith. Yeah. So, you know, the Sangha exists in relationship to society, and the Buddha set it up, you know, very clear in that regard. You know, there's a certain kind of dependency that you live on when you're a Sangha member. And so, for example, the way the Buddha set it up is, you know, you don't work for a living to earn money. You don't buy food. You don't buy and sell things, you know. You live completely as a wandering mendicant on the donations that are given by others. Nowadays, you know, with the establishment of monasteries, things work slightly different in that the monastery, the group, often has things that then they can, you know, you can go to the monastery if you need a new robe, if you need some shoes. These things exist in the storeroom, and you know, and they're given to you. But how did I get on that thing about inspiring the faithful, helping the faithful, those who don't have faith? Anyway, but we exist. Doesn't relate to them. Yeah, it's talking about the relationship with the society. So, yeah, so there's this clear relationship. And if, as monastics, we are greedy and demanding, then the lay people think, why should I support these people? Yeah. And it's actually a way that keeps the monastic behavior in check, which is why I think it's good that we make ourselves explicitly dependent. You know, in some of the traditions, like mostly in the Tibetan tradition, you know, people have their own money and they can go out and buy whatever they want and they can go here and there and do this and that. And I think when you have that power of your own money to do that, then, you know, you don't need to be as mindful and aware of your behavior because you're not as dependent on other people. And, you know, it's much easier for attachment to come in and much easier for impulsiveness to come in. Whereas if you make yourself dependent, then you can't follow every impulse that comes into your mind. And you do realize that your behavior influences the lay people. And if the lay people don't think that you're behaving well as a monastic, they won't support. So it kind of wakes you up, doesn't it? Yeah. And so in Thailand, for example, there's been a lot of different things happening, and when people don't keep their precepts properly, the laity gets very upset and they don't support those monastics. And so it acts as a lesson to kind of to everybody that, you know, this is what we expect of our monastics. Whereas if you have your own money and your own resources and your own car, you don't need to depend on anybody. You just do what you want when you want to. Okay? We had one monastic come here, and he really wanted to live here, but when he heard me say that monastics don't have their own car, whoo, was that a button for him? You know, what a huge button, you know. Because he drove his own car here, and he didn't want to think of having to give it up. And so, you know, even with our monastic rule here, that you don't just get in a car and go to town when you need something. You wait until there's a number of things that are needed, and you learn to plan ahead of what you're going to need. You know, of course, in some dire situations, we have to make quick trips, but, you know, you try and plan ahead and figure out what you're going to need and when you're going to need it. And so, you know, all of that just contributes to making you more aware and more mindful. And, you know, you put yourself in dependence. If you just take one of the monastery's cars and go to town because you feel like it, you're stealing, you know, because it hasn't been freely offered. So, yeah, so this, and it's very interesting because we, you know, those of you who have been here on the winter retreat, we always talk about how, you know, because we do the retreat for the 3 months and how, you know, everybody's so, you know, you hit a point in your meditation where your rubbish is coming up and all you want to do is go running down the hill screaming, you know. We joke about this a lot. But the thing is, if people were allowed to have their own cars, if you had an impulsive mind, when you hit that glitch, you would get in your car and drive down the hill, you know? And actually, that's what happened to that one person. He hit a bump, and he totally disappeared on us. Didn't even say goodbye, got in his car and left. Yeah? So when you don't have your own personal possessions like that, then what it means is you have to stay and work out the situation. Yeah. Now, it all sounds great in theory, but when you're in the middle of it and you hate that situation and you just want to get out of it, you know, it's like, forget that Dharma teaching. But actually, when you see, you know, that's what we need to do when we hit bumps, isn't it? Now, and when we're not getting along with people, or when we feel like everybody's on our case, or our meditation is just distraction, you know, just stay with it and learn to work out the situation. And so I think setting things up that way makes us more dependent and makes us work out the situation. Okay? Because we really also see here what happens with some people who come here and, I mean, the way society is now, sometimes people have so much money at their hands, or their friends and relatives, their parents will do anything for them, that, you know, one small thing happens and it's like, mom and dad, come get me and they're out of here, you know? I think this whole thing about, you know, restraint puts us in a situation of having to work things out, you know? And even if we do eventually need to leave because being here isn't the right thing for us, at least the departure is one that's well thought out and the community understands, and, you know, people depart with a good feeling around them. So I'm going off on all sorts of tangents today. Okay? But are you getting some point out of this? Okay. Yeah. So the same thing with, you know, we only eat the food that's offered to us. When we started the Abbey this way, my monastic friends told me I was totally crazy, that there was no way we were going to get enough food, that we would be hungry. And, you know, because nobody in the Tibetan tradition does this that I know of. And actually, you know, the first time I heard of this, I'd said the same thing. But then I thought, well, let's just try it. And it's actually worked quite well. And I think it brings a certain benefit to the monastics and to the lay people. And we've had some lay people come up, and when they do the verse of, you know, the verses back and forth of offering the food and then the monastics responding, a couple of them said, wow, I get all of this for just a bag of groceries. You know, and then some people, their eyes fill with tears when they're saying it. I mean, it really becomes something meaningful. And for our practice as monastics, you really feel the kindness of others. And then you feel, you know, I have to practice well because these people, you know, we've all worked and we know how hard you have to work to get money. And these people are doing that and then giving us the food that comes from the hours they spend doing their job. So we can't just be demanding and, you know, flippant and wasteful of the food that they offer to us. Okay? So, you know, this mutual relationship that gets set up and that the Buddha wanted. And then as a monastic, you know, our job is to provide a good example to the lay people. That doesn't mean being perfect. We're not perfect, and people who expect us to be perfect have unrealistic expectations. But, you know, our job is to keep our precepts as best as we can and to do our practice. And then on top of that, if we can counsel people, if we can teach, that's great. But not all monastics want to become teachers or are inclined to, you know, have that ability. That may not be people's individual talents, but as long as they're keeping their precepts and doing their meditation practice, then, you know, the lay people see some development and they see the benefit that comes from that. Okay, so it advances the practice of the people who already have faith when we keep our precepts. And also, you know, other people think, wow, you know, they're living like this. Maybe I can too. And so especially, I think, like if we try and live simply, we try and reduce our consumption, and we're very clear about recycling stuff as much as we possibly can, then the lay people who come here, they learn that from us. And they see that, wow, you can be happy, you know, in this way. So I think it's good. It's like, you know, for some people coming here, wow, you don't just jump in the car and go buy chocolate when you want to. And you can still be happy. Wow, what a novel idea. Yeah. And so it expresses something to the world about what is happiness and what are the causes of happiness. And then for people who don't have faith, it also benefits those people because they come and, you know, and they have the same idea, that kind of wake up shock of, you know, oh boy, you know, these people aren't living like everybody else, but they're happy. So what really brings happiness and what doesn't? One monk who's a friend of mine says that he's a Thai in the Thai Theravada tradition. And so before he met the Dharma, he was, you know, as many people, what young Westerners do, he was lying on the beach in Thailand. And, you know, just kind of this attitude. And he went to one of the monasteries, and there are all these monks, and, you know, they can't do this, and they can't do that, and they can't do this, and can't do that. And he said, and they're a whole lot happier than I am, even though I can do all these things. And that really made him stop and think, you know, here I am running from this pleasure to that pleasure, but how happy am I doing that? And here are people who are happier and they're not doing all of it. Okay? So even for people who are new to the Dharma, who don't have faith, the force of the community living in that way makes them think. Okay. Then then there were four advantages that help bring about our individual liberation, how the precepts help us as an individual. So one is they restrain the restive. Okay, so people who are antsy, who are unrestrained, who are reckless, who are restless, yeah, get restrained by the precepts. Precepts make you more aware of your behavior and give you a structure to help you calm yourself down. And they also stabilize the people who have a sense of integrity. So people who have that sense of, you know, I'm a Buddhist practitioner and I want to behave this way and I don't want to behave that way, you know, abiding in the precepts, stabilizes them and helps them continue to practice. And so part of this happens in not just the keeping of the precepts, but the way we confess our transgressions of the precepts. Okay? Because lots of times in regular life, you know, when you do something negative, well, I didn't get caught, I don't need to tell anybody. Okay? But, you know, if you have monastic precepts, twice a month we have a confession and restoration ceremony. And so before that ceremony, you declare the things that you transgressed. And so you get used to learning to be honest with yourself and learning to be open with others. And so that's very, very good for the mind, actually. You know, we can't stuff down and rationalize and have our own little private closet of all of our transgressions while we put on a nice appearance to everybody else. Okay, but so we learn to be open and disclose those things, to have, you know, some attitude of transparency about our behavior, and then we receive support from the community, you know, because everybody else has also had transgressions at various times, maybe not root transgressions, but of different things. And so people understand and people can support us and help us as we go forward in trying to refrain from doing that in the future. Okay, another benefit is that the precepts eliminate present defilements and they prevent defilements from arising in the future. So that's kind of clear, you know, when you live within the precepts, then, if your defilements have arisen in your mind, if you're going to keep your precept, you have to work with your mind and let go of that affliction. And then by training yourself in that way to continuously let go of afflictions, then that acts as a preventative measure for those afflictions arising in the future. Okay? So it's very much a process of training. And I really want to emphasize this because some people, you know, feel like, wow, am I worthy of becoming a monastic? Because they think they have to be perfect and then they ordain, you know. And that's not it at all. If you're already perfect, you don't need to take the precepts. You know, we take the precepts because we aren't perfect. We take the precepts because we need the precepts to help us give a structure to our life. And, you know, we may transgress them. Now, if you feel like it's absolutely too much to take them and you can't possibly keep them, then it's better not to take them. But if you have some feeling that you can keep them fairly well, although, you know, sometimes you may transgress, but you're not going to do a root transgression, then it's valuable to take them because they can really act as a structure within which to train yourself. So we shouldn't have this idea that I need to be perfect and then I ordain. On the other hand, we shouldn't have the idea of I'm not perfect, so it doesn't matter if I break the precepts. Okay. Yeah. So some kind of middle way in there. And then the broader or more general benefit of keeping precepts is for the Dharma to be forever sustained. Okay? And that means, so, I'll quote what she says here. Okay, in the, when we do when the fully ordained ones do our bi-monthly confessional, we open it with, I make obeisance to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Dharma in the Vinaya will now be expounded so that the true Dharma may abide forever. Okay, and so we have that clear in our mind. We keep the Vinaya as a foundation for preserving the Dharma in the world. Yeah. And at the end of our ceremony, we dedicate the merit so that all sentient beings can attain enlightenment altogether. Okay? So, you know, it's bringing us back that, you know, in one way we keep precepts for our own benefit. And people often translate, one of the meanings of pratimoksha is individual liberation. So we think, oh, keeping the precepts will allow me as an individual to improve and to attain liberation. But, you know, if you look, the broader meaning of becoming a monastic is to help the Dharma exist in the world, you know, which means so that other people have access to the Dharma, and so that the Dharma will exist for future generations. And so I think that's really important, because we all came around and have the ability to meet the Dharma because so many other people practiced before us and kept the precepts and learned the Dharma and taught the Dharma. And so, you know, especially when you become fully ordained, then you really see, well, now I have to help do that for future generations so that the Dharma will exist. And the Dharma existing, there's two ways in which the Dharma exists. One is that the teachings are there, and the other is that the realizations are there. So we talk of the scriptural Dharma and the realized Dharma. So one thing is to have the scriptures and the teachings happening. And then that's one way, one level of keeping the Dharma present. Then the second way is by actually realizing it in terms of our own personal experience. And that's the real way to keep the Dharma alive, because if we have experience, then our mind becomes the Dharma. Okay, so that's a little bit more about the benefits of precepts and why we take them. Any questions and comments? Yeah.
You mentioned the bi-monthly presentation right here called Sojung.
Sojung in Tibetan, yeah.
How do you perform it at the Abbey? Do you have enough?
Okay. Yeah, you have to have four fully ordained people. So when visiting Bhikshunis come, then we do it. But we do, in the meantime, we have a confession that we do that, you know, when we come to the full moon, then everybody will take part of it. And we do, we chant the confession prayer, everybody together. And then the lay people go in the house and they read through the refuge and the five lay precepts. And then the Sangha stays here, and then the juniors to, you know, to confession and declare their purity.
And just another question. You were mentioning the Vinaya earlier,
mm-hmm.
and I've noticed that there are differences between the traditions sometimes in the Vinaya. In the Chinese tradition.
Okay.
So, do you like
that? Okay. So, yeah, so the question about different Vinaya traditions. When the Buddha taught, he just taught the Vinaya. Okay, he taught the pratimoksha, that was it. Now, as Buddhism spread to different areas, you know, people went off to spread the Dharma in different areas. They didn't have modern communication at that time to keep in touch with each other. And also the tradition was an oral tradition, so all the precepts weren't written down for 500 years after the Buddha was there. Everything was passed down orally. So considering that situation, that there was no communication and that it was an oral tradition, the similarity amongst the different present Vinaya schools is really rather remarkable. Okay? Because what happened is, as you know, Buddhism went to these different directions, you had the development of different traditions. So everybody talks about 18 of the early schools. And some people say there were Abhidharma schools, and some people say there were Vinaya schools, and we can't even agree on the list of the 18 names or on the subcategories, but everybody agrees on the list of 18 schools. In any case, there are at present only 3 extant Vinaya lineages. Yeah. And that is the Theravada that's practiced in Southeast Asia, the Dharmaguptaka, which is practiced in China, Vietnam, Korea, and then the Mulishavastivada, which is followed in Tibet and Mongolia. So the precepts are remarkably similar amongst these. There are some different details in them. Yeah, and actually, and the Theravada, they wear sleeves too, which I found interesting because most people, I don't know if this is accurate or not, but most people think the Theravadas are the strictest, but they'll wear sleeves or sleeves and hats, whereas the Tibetans say, well, not all the Tibetans, by the way, some of the Tibetans wear sleeves and hats. Some of them, you know, say no sleeves, no hats, that's against Vinaya, but then, you know, other things they negotiate on. But, you know, you can't wear a sleeve, you can't wear sleeves, but you can wear a big heavy cape.
Yeah.
Yeah. Personally speaking, this is one of the things that I don't understand. Why is a big heavy cape okay, but sleeves are not okay? Yeah, if the purpose is to keep you warm and to keep you healthy. So I don't understand that. And so usually in the West, you know, we wear sleeves. But what we try and do here at the Abbey anyway is during teachings, then we don't wear sleeves. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Other questions? Oh, okay.
I think you've answered this for me before, but I don't remember the answer. When there is a male and female sangha, the confession will be done together, even when they're fully ordained.
Okay, so when we have enough bhikshus and enough bhikshunis here, traditionally the confession is done separately because they have different sets of precepts. And some of the precepts, people feel more comfortable confessing to people of their own gender. So, no, it's at Gampo Abbey. They do it, everybody all together, and then slowly different groups leave. But the fully ordained people do their sojung together. So they adapted it in that way. Who knows, maybe in future years we'll do that, but right now I'll just try and keep it the way it's set up in Vinaya.
I have a question about your own interpretation and adaptations and how they came about for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your own understanding and how much after you went to Taiwan and received that training. Just, you know, how, yes, that story.
Okay. So how I came to my own adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
With great difficulty and with constant checking. Can I have somebody turn off these lights? Lights in the daytime. I find distracting. Thank you. How do you turn that? Okay. Everybody can still see? Okay. How I got to my own adaptation. You know, I was in the Tibetan tradition for 9 years before I went to Taiwan because I didn't even know that it was possible to go for many, many years. So I just kind of adapted to some of the Tibetan conventions and etiquette and things like that. You know, for example, in Tibetan Buddhism, when you have to blow your nose, you go like this, and then you blow your nose. Now, do you think I'm going to do that in the West? Yeah? I don't even do it in front of Tibetans anymore now. You know? So I had kind of mastered Tibetan things. Then I went to Taiwan, and I had to relearn a whole different way of doing things. And there's different etiquette things. Some things that Tibetans thought were okay isn't okay in Chinese tradition, and vice versa. And some of the things don't fit in American things. Like in Taiwan, it's completely acceptable to burp out loud, to just belch. But, you know, here we don't do that. In Tibetan, if to show respect to somebody, you stick out your tongue. You know, here you don't do that. You know, we don't put our heads, our cloth over our heads here when we blow our nose. The Tibetans think that that's, you know, not so nice. You know, so there's all these different kinds of things that I became aware of just living in different cultures. And, you know, okay, what's culture and what's Buddhism? And so that whole theme for me of what's culture and what's Buddhism was a real big thing for many, many years as I was trying to see, you know, what's similar in different cultures and what's different in different cultures and, you know, to what extent and in what circumstances will I do things according to Tibetan culture, according to Chinese culture, according to Western culture. So I, you know, I kind of investigated a lot of these things. Then I also watched, you know, what happened. The Tibetans themselves in the monasteries, you know, they're a refugee culture and they're refugees. But more than that, they're confronting modernity. So even if they were in Tibet, it would be the same situation of confronting modernity. And so how do you relate to videos? You know, and to watch what they did when all the monks wanted to go see Kung Fu videos. Yeah. So they, not maybe not all the monks, but many of them, you know, because they have all these young monks with all, you know, this energy. They like seeing Kung Fu. So, you know, they were going into the video shops in town. And then that doesn't look good to see monks in video shops in town. So they dealt with it by bringing the Kung Fu movies to the monastery and showing them in the monastery. Now, that is not the way I want to deal with that kind of situation. What I want to do instead is to talk about how watching Kung Fu movies is not in line with the aim of our monastic life, and it does not fulfill the aim of, you know, it does not fulfill our spiritual yearnings. And so I want to approach it by talking about, you know, okay, why are we here and why are we doing what we're doing, and that this isn't in a line with what we ourselves are here to do. But you see, there's also a difference, because here we're ordaining adults who are choosing to ordain. In the Tibetan monasteries, you have a lot of people who were put there by their families who didn't choose. Yeah? And so, you know, it's a very, very different situation. So then, okay, when this kind of thing comes up, I'm going to deal with it in a different way than what they do. And I try and not, you know, I don't, yeah, anyway. Okay? So many kinds of things like this. And then, you know, I watch what other Westerners do. In Australia, the monks and nuns go to the beach and wear bathing suits. I don't think that's... And I've seen some Tibetans do that, not only Westerners. I've seen Tibetans do that when they're in the West. I don't think that's good for the mind, you know? I just don't think it's good for the mind. So if you need to go swimming because you have back problems and you need to be in the pool for exercise, then, you know, you wear shorts or something that covers you more, and you're in a pool with only people of your own sex. You know, and you don't lie in the sun and get a suntan afterwards. You just go in and do your exercise and leave. Okay? So, you know, sometimes I just watch what other people do and then, you know, cause, and what the Tibetan Lamas choose to comment on, what they don't choose to comment on. And so that's why in many ways what we do here is a little bit stricter than what you'll find many other Tibetan monastics doing. But that, a lot of that just comes from my experience. You know, if you go to the beach and you're wearing bathing suits and you're getting a suntan and you're obviously looking at other people's bodies and you're obviously going to be wondering about what your own body looks like, and it's a perfect setting for the arisal of attachment. Yeah, so let's not do that. Yeah, okay. So I think that's also kind of one reason I wanted to just start something myself, was that I was finding it very difficult living in these situations where things were not very clear-cut about how the group was going to act. And I wanted to keep one level of discipline, and other people wanted to keep another level of discipline. And there was nobody, including our teachers, wanted to necessarily comment on anything. And so I found that rather uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship between Sri Bhakti Adi and other Western Bhana, like Gampo Adi and...
We're friends.
Yeah?
Yeah. We're friends. Yeah.
You know, like helping ideas from one another.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I've talked to Pema Chodron, and her, you know, she's told me different things. And one of the reasons we got a master plan for our building is she said, figure out what you want first and then build it. Don't just kind of build as you go along as you need it, because you're going to wind up with things that aren't useful if you do that. So that was her advice. You know, so... And we have monastic meetings of the monastics from different traditions every year. We have done it for 14 years. So we really compare notes and we learn from each other, and a very, very nice relationship. Yeah?
How many, are we going to have at the Abbey different traditional?
No, we're going to follow everybody's going to follow the Dhammaguttaka.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, it just makes everything much easier, and the whole Tibetan controversy about Bhikshuni ordination, we leave that behind, and, you know, we have a very, you know, that's my full ordination is in that tradition, and we have a lot of support from Chinese monastics, and so we'll just do that. Makes it much easier, I think. Yeah. Okay.
Just one comment I wanted to add. When the Venerable Sunim, whose full name I can never remember, from Korea was here, it's something that I think is very striking for all of us, because she talked about how she was kind of a radical in her own tradition, but that she said she was coming from 1,000 years of Buddhism, and in some ways there was the room for her to be a radical. But she said, for you have to be very, very strict. Because it's new here. And that was really her perspective from being a radical, that we didn't have any room to hold it lightly.
Yeah.
That made quite an impression on me.
Yeah, because you can see when there's... Also, she comes from a tradition where there's thousands of monastics. So if one's a radical, you know... Everything's like that. But here, we don't have thousands of monastics. And so if everybody's just kind of going their own way and doing you know, it gets very chaotic and confusing. We're going to have to stop because in an hour I teach again. Okay? So let's just sit quietly for a minute and then I'll dedicate. So you can write your questions down and then we can talk about them tomorrow. certificate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. So at you'll take a break and have medicine meal, and at 22 we will be ready for some meditation prior to the teaching. Thank you.